How many of you found yourselves in the greeting card aisle the night before a special occasion? Or maybe for some of you men, maybe it's the day of your anniversary, and you're shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of other men who are searching, and they're on the hunt for that special card before it's too late. Maybe for some reason in our culture, it's become acceptable and an expected practice to pay big money for painted paper. And so we pay an exorbitant amount of money. And we pay this money so that we can get that card and then we can give it to our loved one. Greeting cards are part of our culture, serving as an expression of who we are. So it shouldn't surprise us, and we should take note when a new line of greeting cards come out for adulterers. A few years ago, the Los Angeles Times reported that Kathy Gallagher developed a line of greeting cards for couples involved in an adulterous affair. The whole idea is profoundly sick and really speaks about our society today. In the article entitled "Adulterers Need Cards Too," the writer described a Christmas card developed for this series in which it includes this line: "As we each celebrate with our families, I will be thinking about you." According to the Los Angeles Times, Ms. Gallagher says her secret lover collection of cards, these 24 cards, are first in a new line of exclusive cards for people in an adulterous affair. She says she expects, no pun intended, she expects hot sales. Gallagher says her cards express sentiments that people in affairs have a hard time expressing to even their best of friends. And she says this: "These aren't sex cards, they're emotional. No other card reflects having to share someone and not being able to be with somebody on the holidays. Nothing like a little home-wrecking sentiment to warm the heart of an adulterer at Christmas time." It's shocking for us to hear these words because of the illicit breaking and the explicit breaking of the intimate love and fidelity and trust that is exclusive to the marriage relationship. And simultaneously, it breaks our hearts. Is how many people endure and experience great heartache and great grief in the face of this serious sin of adultery. It's very likely that there may even be people here in this room this morning who have endured the grief and the hurt that this sin brings, or perhaps you're trapped in this sin. The reality is that we live in an adulterous generation. We've institutionalized and trivialized adultery because of our entertainment culture. And although one might expect this kind of behavior to come from a world who does not embrace the biblical teaching of morality, this serious sin too often is committed by those who claim to be children of God. When we talk about adultery, we're really talking about sexuality in broader terms. And the Bible has much to say about sex. And unfortunately, the church probably largely has sat there silent and largely ignored the Bible's vast teaching on sex. The Bible's full of sex, both good and bad. It's full of instruction for the proper enjoyment of sex within the bonds of marriage. I mean, all you have to do is read Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, or the Song of Songs, the book of Song of Solomon, and not take it allegorically, but take it as it stands, and you'll see very quickly, and you'll realize that the Bible deals very straightforwardly about human sexuality and sexual sin. It also deals very clearly with what's prescribed and what's prohibited when it comes to sex. The seventh commandment, "Do not commit adultery," points us to several of those places in scriptures where we see how God views sexual sin and how crucial it is for us to deal with it. So we're going to examine this commandment this morning by asking four important questions. The first question is this: what is the command? What is the command? Now, if I were to ask several of you this morning, before the service for you to define for me adultery, it's most likely that many of you probably would come up with similar definitions. I mean, some of you might say it's cheating on your spouse, or others might say it's stealing somebody's wife. So we probably all would have pretty similar ideas and definitions of what adultery is, and it would be consistent with the original recipients of this command. Hebrew word for adultery, when we're considering the historical meaning of adultery, it means marital infidelity or sexual intercourse that breaks the bonds of the marriage covenant. The Hebrew word for adultery appears 34 times in the Old Testament. And actually, the rabbis, they taught a lot about sex. They talked a whole lot about lust and about fornication. But when they dealt with this, they didn't deal with it primarily as the issue of the heart. They dealt with it primarily as a sin against one's neighbor. Now, the punishment, according to the Old Covenant, is very severe. The punishment for committing adultery was death by stoning or by burning. We see this in Deuteronomy 20 and Leviticus 20. It seems historically that when we think about the Old Testament understanding of adultery, they got one thing right and they got one thing wrong. What it seems that they got right was that the lines were very clearly drawn. Adultery is a serious sin against God, and the punishment is severe. But what they seemed to get wrong was they seemed to have a very narrow view of the expressions of adultery. So, the historic meaning of the command is important because it protects marriage itself. So, we look at the historic meaning of this command. Also want to look at the theological meaning of this command. Now, in order for us to really talk about the theological meaning of this command, we really have to start at the biblical theology of marriage. Genesis 2, what did God do? He created one man and one woman to exist in an intimate relationship of fidelity and love for a lifetime. He designed Adam and Eve's marriage to reflect his love for the church. Now, why did he do this? He was providing a symbol. He was providing a sign of his love for the church. That was his plan. It was God's intentional foreshadowing of his love for the church. So what are the implications here? Now, catch this. This is very important. When we mar or we violate God's plan, we blur the picture that he's trying to demonstrate and to show to the world. Now, what is the picture? What is the picture that this plan of this covenant relationship between a man and a woman, what is it supposed to display? Well, we find out the connection between God's plan and the picture that he wants to display when we read Ephesians chapter 5. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. Let me ask you this morning, when was Christ's love placed upon the church? Was it placed upon the church after he set out and instituted the bond of marriage? According to Ephesians chapter 1, actually, God's love and Christ's love was placed upon the church long before he instituted marriage. Ephesians 1. Before the foundations of the world, his love was placed upon the church. And for this reason, it's critical for us to understand that before humanity existed, God wanted to put a symbol on this planet, a covenant sign. He wanted to embed it into the tapestry of humanity. And the way that he chose to do this was he instituted marriage. It was a sign and symbol to display a picture of his covenant love for us. So let me see if I can just summarize this. God's plan is marriage. One man, one woman. An intimate fidelity and love for life. It's a sign and symbol of a picture. What's the picture? The picture is his love for us. So when you violate the plan, when you violate what God has set out in the marriage covenant, you blur his picture. How many of you remember those old slide projectors? Remember those things? Our family had one of them, and every once in a while in the evening, we'd get it out, and we'd set it up and view some pictures from our childhood, and we'd just have some good laughs, you know. But I distinctly remember how these things worked. I mean, this was like the cutting-edge multimedia presentation, right? Do you remember this? It's kind of funny. I mean, these clunky little things, and half the times they jam, they wouldn't work right. But anyway, they had these canisters, and within the canisters, all these little slides that would pop down, these little negatives that were like framed in paper. And so when that canister would advance, that slide would just pop down in that projector, and the light would shine through. And what would it do? It would take that small picture, and what would it do? It would display this big picture up on the screen. Now, if you marred or you did something to the slide, or something happened to the slide that altered it or changed it, what did it do to the picture? It magnified and it highlighted how you marred the plan. Do you understand this? How do we mar God's plan? How do we mar it? How do we mess with the slide? Well, our text tells us this morning that we do this when we commit adultery. Now, if we extend this principle, when we engage in fornication, sexual immorality, premarital sex, 1 Thessalonians 4, we mar God's plan. We mar God's plan when we lust sexually with our eyes. We mar God's plan when we engage in solo sex in front of a computer. We mar God's plan when we engage in homosexual sin. Don't you see that if we violate God's plan, which is sexual union, we're also blurring the picture, spiritual union between Christ and his church, a picture he desires to clearly display to the world. So the first question we've asked is, what is the command? And we've seen its theological and historic definition. We also must consider this morning, what is the cause? What is the cause? Now, there's no greater passage in the scriptures that exposes the cause of this great sin than the passage that you turn to at the beginning of the message, Matthew chapter 5. So if you'd look there, Matthew 5, we're looking in verse 27. We hear Jesus preaching, and he says something that took the Jewish understanding of adultery, and it turned it on its head. Here in this passage, we see Christ, and we hear him quoting this commandment, and he exposes the cause. Listen to what he says. Verse 27. You have heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. What God is doing here is he's calling people to a standard that's not just about body parts in motion. It is now about the heart and its inclination. He exposes that the cause of this great sin stems from the desires of our lustful hearts. Let's take a close look at what he says. Here he says, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent. The word looks here is a present participle. It means a studied look with sexual intent. Now, this is not just noticing somebody. It's actually gazing at them with sexual intention. This is a person who has someone in their sights whom they want to have sex with. And they may have gone to some lengths to try to plan to do so. Craig Keener says in his commentary that Jesus refers not to noticing a person's beauty, but to imbibing it, meditating on it, seeking to possess it. Now, this is not a new idea. When we consider what Job said in Job chapter 31, Job's declaration of innocence, he actually alludes to this three different times. Job's 31 in verse 1, he says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. How then can I gaze at a virgin? Verse 7, if my steps have turned, my heart followed my eyes. In other words, his eyes led him lustfully away, and then his heart followed. He refers to this also in verse 9. So where does adultery come from? Where does it come from? Matthew 15 answers the question. It says, therefore, out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality. You see here, we are not protected by age. We're not protected by position. We're not protected by reputation. So we have to understand something this morning. Every one of our hearts are fundamentally flawed, and we're all susceptible to this sin. The story is told of an old seminary professor, taught at Westminster Seminary. He taught there for decades. His name was Cornelius Van Til, and he retired at an old age, and he used to have seminary students come over to his house. And they'd come over to his house, and they would converse, and he would try to mentor these men. And a student once turned to Dr. Van Til, and he asked him what it was like to be at such an age when sexual temptation is no longer a problem. And what Dr. Van Til said, he looked at him and he said, I wouldn't know, young man. The sins of my youth are the sins of my old age. Adultery, sexual immorality starts in the heart. So can we continue to explore why this statement by Jesus was so shocking? Now, in order to really understand why this really just stood in the face of the Old Testament understanding of adultery, is you have to kind of dig a little bit into Jewish teaching. Okay, so Jewish men thought and rabbis taught that women were to wear head coverings. Married women were to wear head coverings. Unmarried women wouldn't. Now, why wouldn't unmarried women have to wear head coverings? Well, they were trying to attract a spouse. But the married women would wear head coverings. And they would wear them for one express purpose. It was to prevent men from lusting after them. So the idea is, and you see this all throughout Islamic culture today, the idea is that if you're a woman, it is your responsibility to wear a head covering so that I don't lust after you. So what does Jesus do? He turns around and he cuts through excuse making. He cuts through the blame shifting. And he says, if you're looking at a woman for purpose of lusting after her, you are committing adultery in your heart. It's your problem, it's not hers. Now, lest I be accused this morning of being a sexist, I don't think that Jesus was precluding the idea of women lusting after men. I mean, doesn't this inform us not only about the fact that this is really at the heart of this sin, both for men and for women? It also instructs us about how we approach what we wear. I mean, this is just a little bit of a side application, but just think about it for a second. Obviously, what needs to govern what we wear, modesty is the principle. It's appropriateness. You can cover yourself from head to toe with a tent, and it is not going to cure the problem of the lust of the heart. Modesty, appropriateness. We need to ask ourselves these questions. Because on the flip side, is it possible to dress in such a way that you are actually inviting lust? Yes, it's possible. So Jesus here, he's telling us that this commandment governs our inward thoughts as well as our outward actions. It covers both the desires of our heart and the deeds of the body. Now, does God care who you sleep with? Absolutely, he does. But he also deeply cares about what you look at and He deeply cares about what you desire. So how do we commit inward adultery? How do we commit the adultery of the heart? Well, when we read sexual literature, like romance novels, it causes the mind to fantasize about sexual pursuits outside of marriage. When we sit and fantasize about relationships that include sexual intimacy. Men, some of you may say, I'm not pursuing pornography. I'm not viewing pornography. But yet you feast in a fantasy world of the log of images that are stored up in your mind. We commit heart adultery when we make suggestive comments or dirty jokes. When the pattern of our thinking imagines having sexual intercourse with someone that's not our spouse. When this becomes the routine habit of our life, it doesn't matter if we're going to the grocery store or we're driving a car down the street, we see someone walking down the sidewalk, we turn people's bodies into objects of our own lusts. This is what Jesus is exposing here. And we clearly see that this is such a serious problem both in the church and without the church. Why? Because the cause of the sin originates where? It originates in the heart. So we've asked the question, what is the command? We've asked the question, what is the cause? The cause is the desires of our own lustful hearts. The third question we want to ask this morning is, what is the cost? What is the cost? Now, there's really two aspects of this that we really need to consider this morning. The first is the cost of breaking the command. Breaking the command. The cost for breaking the command in the Old Testament, remember what it was? It was stoning, burning. And I don't just want to just skip over that because I believe that there's something that we need to really catch here. Remember in the Old Covenant, the penalty for breaking God's laws were so swift, they were sure, they were severe. And the fact that the death penalty was the punishment for the sin of adultery should inform us and should indicate the detestable nature of sin from God's perspective. I mean, do you realize that the death penalty is not just connected to this sin? It's connected to several other of the Ten Commandments. It instructs us about how God views sin. You see, redemption and forgiveness only find their value when we know the weight of our sin. And so it's really foreshadowing the fact that sin brings death. You dishonor your parents, you die. You worship another god, you die. You murder someone, you die. You commit adultery, you die. Now you fill in the blank. Fill in your sin. You die. The wages of sin is death. God is serious about us breaking His laws. Let's continue to consider the cost. What will it cost your marriage? What will it cost your marriage? It violates the trust between a husband and wife. In a recent statistics show that 40% of marriages end in divorce. This is sad. And nearly half of those in divorce happen because result of this sin of adultery. What will it cost your family? I mean, this sin commits treason against the family and God hates it. Creates lifelong scars and robs children of their sense of security. What will it cost society? It begins a breakdown of order that threatens the entire society. I mean, how can we trust each other in society if we can't trust each other in our most intimate of commitments? How can we trust each other in commerce, in politics, in business, in culture, and in life? Now that we've talked about the cost of the breaking of the command, I want to talk to you about the cost of keeping it. And it's easy for us to think about the cost of breaking the command, right? But I want to surface for us the sacrifice and the obedience that's connected to keeping the command. Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, you're going to need to count the cost. So what will it cost you to obey this? We'll turn back to Matthew chapter 5, back to this passage where Jesus is making this statement here in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:29. And he says this, if your right eye causes you to sin, you tear it out. I mean, this sounds pretty radical, doesn't it? Look at verse 30. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Now, understand something here. There's an important aspect to biblical interpretation that you must understand. You must pay close attention to. Otherwise, you might harm yourself. You might harm yourself. The origin of Alexandria thought in the 3rd century, he thought that he was speaking literally, and he castrated himself. He started a trend. I mean, could you imagine being a trendsetter? I mean, I can't imagine how and why this caught on, but it did. I mean, the problem is it misses the whole point. This is a heart issue, not an eyeball or a hand issue. Let's face it, we don't have enough eyeballs to remove or to pluck out, and we don't have enough hands to chop off. It's become such a problem, and it became such a problem in the 3rd century that the Council of Nicaea in 325, they forbid Christians from self-mutilation. I mean, Jesus says here, and these are shocking words, if your right eye causes you to sin. Then he goes on, he says, if your right hand causes you to sin. He says, I have the perfect remedy for you. If it is your eye, remove it from you and throw it away from you. If it is your hand, cut it off from you and throw it away from you. Don't think that because Jesus is not speaking literally here, it's not a serious statement. The point is, we must deal radically and ruthlessly with our sin. We must be willing to perform radical amputation. And when Jesus says, if that eye is constantly causing you to sin because that eye is constantly lustfully looking around in order to commit adultery in the heart, this is what you're supposed to do. Some translations say this. Some say gouge it out and then throw it away. I mean, every once in a while you hear a story of a man and he's out in the woods somewhere, far from civilization, and he's logging or he's hunting, and what happens? A log falls on him or a rock falls on him. He's like a mile from his truck. He's like 40 miles from civilization. The night's coming and he knows that he's either going to get eaten by coyotes or bears or he's going to bleed to death. So what does he do? He takes out his trusty Swiss Army knife and he starts hacking off one of his own limbs in order to save his life. I mean, I hear stories, I don't know about you, but I hear stories like this and I conclude very quickly that I probably would just die. Right? I mean, I can think of a whole lot of things that I would do to survive. But cutting off my own hand, my own leg, I mean, it's an awful thought. Imagine digging in and pulling out your eyeball. Imagine taking a hacksaw and actually hacking off your right hand. And the imagery is supposed to be shocking for us for the very reason that Jesus is saying to you, you need to deal radically and ruthlessly with your sin. The idea of radical means to the root. It means do whatever is necessary to root that sin out of your life. You say, what does this look like? Well, it looks like avoiding temptation at all cost. Jay Adams tells the story of a man that he was teaching at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. This guy comes to Jay Adams and says, I've got to talk to you. I've got this new job. It's a great job. It's getting us through seminary. But in order to get to this job, I've got to drive through the red light district. And by the time I get to work, I'm so white hot with lust, I can't think of anything else. And Jay Adams looks at him and he says, is there another way to work? And this man responds, yes, but it'll take an extra 15 minutes. You know what Jay Adams said? He said, don't you think that your soul is worth 15 minutes? I mean, this is not too extreme, is it? I mean, it's taking a choice to get something out of your life. That's what the emphasis is here. We don't actually continue being on friendly terms with the right eye or right hand that is causing us to sin. This also means fleeing immorality. Isn't this what Paul says? He says, flee immorality. You're not supposed to stand there and take a stand. You're supposed to flee. By the way, this is what Joseph did. I mean, he literally fled so that his coat is in Mrs. Potiphar's hand. Spurgeon said this, the best antidote to temptation is often a good pair of legs and the king's highway. We're to flee. What does it look like to perform radical amputations? What looks like eliminating anything that causes you to sin? I mean, you might need to eliminate the internet. You might need to change jobs. You might need to change friends. You know, obviously, our immediate response is, but I like working there. I mean, I like that person. I like that department. I mean, here's the reality. Things that are so dear to us and important to us is right eyes and right hands that cause us to sin means performing radical amputations. Plucking out right eyes and hacking off right hands might mean that you have to change your job. I mean, maybe there's someone at work, and every time you're around them, I mean, it's an incredible source of temptation. And you think, well, I can handle it. I can handle it. And think about those words, I can handle it. And all too often, those are the last words that are spoken before two people end up sleeping together. Perhaps this means that you request a change of job or assignment. Believe it or not, there are people around you that have bad intentions. And you wed their bad intentions with your lustful heart, and the consequences could be deadly. Part of plucking out right eyes and cutting off right hands might mean that you have to be transferred. So there's that friend that hangs out with a friend, and she's real flirtatious, and she shows a little bit too much skin, too much more than she should. And so you know that every time you're around her, your heart starts beating a little faster. And you can't help but lust in your heart. You know what Jesus says here? It's better for you to end that friendship than to keep that friendship. Are you willing to end that friendship that provides the emotional and relational satisfaction and security that you are not finding in your spouse? Women, are you willing to go to an all-women's gym instead of the gym you go to where there's a constant temptation to lust after men? Are you willing to change your reading habits or watching habits? I mean, maybe you need to put Covenant Eyes or some kind of program on your computer that allows someone else to see what you're looking at. I mean, Grant Osborne writes, the issue has become pandemic. Every church and Christian group should be seeking solutions more vigorously than in the past. There's a recent university study that wanted to find out the effects of watching internet pornography. So they were looking for two test groups. They were looking for one group who had viewed internet pornography, and they were looking for another test group that hadn't viewed internet pornography. But you know what? The study never got started because they could not find one student who had not viewed internet pornography. And these issues may require accountability. I mean, actually telling your spouse, you know, I really struggle with this, and I've sinned. Seeking forgiveness. Getting a close friend to come alongside you and to keep you accountable. Not someone who's going to say, it's okay. It's someone who's really going to keep you accountable. I know someone who decided that they couldn't have a computer. You say, well, it's 2014. You've got to have a computer. Where in the Bible does it say that you have to have a computer? Where in the Bible does it say that you have to have cable? Where in the Bible does it say that you have to have a television? Now, I'm not saying go home this morning and get a hammer and just like smash up your monitor. Although, maybe for some of us, that may not be a bad thing. Next, discipline your mind to right thinking and imagination. I mean, understand that this kind of lust in the heart is directly tied to what we put in front of our eyes and our heart. John Stott said this, deeds of shame are preceded by fantasies of shame. Deeds of shame just don't pop up out of thin air. Deeds of shame are preceded by fantasies of shame and the inflaming of the imagination by the indiscipline of the eyes. There is a connection between what we put into our minds, what we fill our imaginations with, and what comes out in our life. Weigh your conscience down with the consequences of sexual sin. Weigh your conscience down with everything that will happen as a result of that sin. What will happen to your marriage? What will happen to your family? What will happen to your reputation? What will happen to your relationship with God? I mean, sin is always seductive, isn't it? Sin always lies. I mean, sin in sexual temptation, it never says, I'm going to ruin your life. I'm going to make you absolutely miserable. I'm going to destroy your marriage. Sound fun? Sin says, I pay incredible, pleasurable dividends, and nobody has to know. I would remind you that God knows. And you will know. And your conscience will know. Thomas Manton said that those morsels of sin which tasted so good going down are loathsome when you have to barf them back up in confession. Weigh down your conscience with the consequences of sin. You say, well, this cost is awfully heavy. Radical amputation. Anything that causes you to sin. But notice what Jesus does. He moves right to the consequence. So why am I motivated to deal radically and ruthlessly with my sin? Why am I willing to perform the most radical of amputations? Well, look again, Matthew 5:29. Look what Jesus says. He said, it is better for one of your members to be destroyed than your whole body to be cast into hell. It's better for one of your members, your eye or your hand, to be destroyed than your whole body to be thrown into hell. I mean, you can sit here and try to perform all kinds of exegetical or interpretational gymnastics to get around what Jesus is saying here, but the safest way to interpret this and to understand the text is to understand it like this. It is better for one of your members to be destroyed than your whole body to be cast into hell. Remember what's at stake. If you coddle and cultivate this sin, you will take it with you right into the pit of hell. Now, we certainly cannot end the message here. I mean, this is heavy. This is something that really strikes at the heart of every single person in this room, including myself. If we ended right here, you might conclude that if you try to eliminate this sin from your life and strive with all your strength to remain sexually pure, you could actually conquer this on your own. When all of your efforts to try to keep this command and maintain the sexual purity, the standard that Jesus sets, falls so far short. None of us can stand before Christ's demands for purity. We need the one who is tempted as we are, yet without sin. And that leads us really to our last question, and that question is this: what is the cure? What is the cure? Friend, I want you to know that Jesus is your only hope for the transformation of your heart. Do you realize that Jesus didn't come just to save your soul? He came to redeem your life. Jesus came to redeem your sexuality. And Christ, I want to remind us that Christ is the only one who has met the standard he has set for sexual purity. He's the only one. My friend, perhaps you've lived a life enslaved by sexual sin. And you know you need to be rescued from it. Jesus offers himself and the power to overcome the sin through his life. He doesn't want you to try to be a better person. He wants to transform your heart. He wants to offer his righteousness of sexual purity to you. There's a precious story in the book of John, John chapter 8. Actually, there's a woman who was brought before the Lord by the Pharisees. It's a woman who was caught in the sin of adultery. The Pharisees brought her before the Lord, saying, according to the law of Moses, she should be stoned. They asked Jesus, what should we do with her? The scriptures say that they did this because they were trying to trap Jesus. They were trying to bring a charge against the Savior. Jesus stands, he looks at them, and he says, let him who is without sin among you be the first to throw a stone at her. And when they heard it, one by one, they walked away convicted of their sin. Jesus was left standing there alone with this woman. He was standing there. Listen to what Jesus says to this woman. He says, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? And this is what she said. Love this. She says, no one, Lord. And Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. Go, and from now on, sin no more. No one can afford to leave this story out when considering the nature of breaking the seventh commandment, for it is the one place that becomes crystal clear, absolutely clear, that though the penalty of our sin remains, the penalty for this woman who is caught up in adultery, the penalty for her sin remains. But there is one, Jesus Christ, who, like he stood with her on that day, will stand for you and will offer forgiveness for your sin and offer perfect pardon for your sins. Come to Jesus. Come to him and be overcome and overwhelmed by the freeing grace of God. Now, we not only find the cure in Jesus, who is the only hope for the transformation of our heart. We find the cure in Jesus, who is our only hope and source of eternal joy. Christian, would you cultivate your love for Christ? Cultivate your love for Christ. Old Testament tells us a story of the temptation of a man named Joseph. He's a young man away from home in a foreign country where nobody knew him. Joseph was a single man in Egypt and landed an incredible job with an extremely rich man by the name of Potiphar. He became his business manager. Now, Potiphar had a wife that took a liking to Joseph, and she tried to seduce him. Joseph refused, but Potiphar's wife was not so easily discouraged. Day after day, she would appear. She would stand there giving him the eye, trying to entice him, and the pressures were relentless. But the Bible records there the single strategy that sustained Joseph and enabled him to stand throughout his entire time of temptation. You know what it was? We find it in the words of Joseph, and he says this before God. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? He called the temptation as it was. It was an occasion to sin. And he saw the wound that would bring to the heart of God if he yielded to it. Listen, friends, if you are going to overcome the power of temptation, You need to see your sin and connect it to the cross of Jesus Christ. Having been redeemed from sin by the blood of Jesus, how could you go back and do this to Him? How could you do it? The strength of your love for Christ will be the key to triumph over sexual temptation. And simply put, what all of us need to get to a place in our life, we all need to be in a place where we love God more than we love body parts. There's good news this morning. The cure is found in Jesus. The cure is found in Him. He's the balm for the guilty heart, and He's the satisfaction to the needy heart. So we need to run to Him this morning and find His grace.